the Loan Market Association Multi-Currency Term and Revolving Facilities Agreement. The euro loan market, to a significant extent, with the wider euro-dollar market and other key international financial markets, principally operate through the use of standard documentation prepared by the key trade associations. The principal trade association in the loan banking area is the Loan Market Association, LMA. The key trade association in the capital markets area is the International Capital Markets Association, ICMA, that was made up, created from a merger of the International Primary Markets Association, IPMA, and the International Secondary Markets Association, ISMA. We also then have a third key trade association, the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, ISDA, in the derivatives area. The international financial markets, to a large extent, then operate through the use of standard documentation prepared by these key trade associations, which governs, determines all of the rights and obligations of the parties in this area. The core document that's used in the loan market specifically is the Multi-Currency Term and Revolving Facilities Agreement. This is both a term loan, that's for a specific fixed period, as well as it also incorporates a revolving facility. We will see that there's an A and a B facility on the left-hand side at the top. There's an A multi-currency term loan and then a revolving B facility as well, loan facility. That's provided for in sections 21A and section 21B. This document then sets out all of the standard terms and conditions that apply with regards to any typical standard loan documentation, loan arrangement, loan relationship at the international and national level. All of the key clauses and provisions are incorporated here. All that simply has to happen is that we need to work through this and determine to what extent it applies with regards to the facts and circumstances of the particular facility that we are entering into. This then operates by way of a standard template to provide all of the core clauses that we can use in any particular factual circumstance that may arise. I have summarized all of the key provisions on the outline on the left-hand side. This basically is four pages, although this can be printed one page left and right and then front and back, which reduces all of this to one page to allow any user to understand the whole of the document on just one page. The full document is around 100 pages long and sets out all of the key provisions in almost perfect legal English. This is simple, short, succinct, clear and direct. It is a perfect example of legal drafting. The only issue is that the contents outline are not separately structured, so it's quite difficult from an initial reading to see how all of this fits together and to understand this, but we can do that from the separate outline provided on the left. What we're essentially doing is this. We are entering into a revolving multi-currency term loan. So it's both for a term and the revolver. It's going to provide the lending arrangements, the funding that the borrower and the related borrowers, the borrower's group, require over a particular period of time. This might be, for example, 10 years or 20 years. We can assume, by way of example, that this is one borrower with 10 subsidiaries borrowing from 10 banks in the syndicate for up to 100 million. If we use that as an example, we can then begin to understand how all of these different clauses and provisions apply. In terms of the key clauses and the key terms and conditions, we then have the definitions are set out in one with a separate construction and then disapplication of third-party rights clause. That's 1.1, 1.2, 1.3. The facilities are identified in clause 2. That's the A, the term facility, and B, the revolver. We've then got a purpose statement in 3. Most standard euro-dollar transaction facilities, most of the core international euro-dollar transaction deals will not have a purpose. These will be unsecured with no specific purpose. It's just for general financing support, whichever the borrower or company concerned wants to, company or government concerned wants to use the facilities for. If it's for a particular tied purpose, for example, in relation to a property purchase of some form and an asset purchase, maybe it's a shipping loan or an aircraft loan, or maybe it's a project finance deal, we will specify a purpose often, and then we'll want to monitor and confirm that. We're going to have the key financials will be set out in the facilities. We're then going to have the three sets of obligations. So we have the conditions precedent. Those are provided for in 4. We're then going to have the representations and warranties in 19. And we have the corporates and then the financials, the financial representations and warranties in 20. We're then going to have the continuing covenants. The financial covenants are in 21. And then the more general corporate covenants are in 22. We then tie all of these to the events of default 23 with a number of other general and key provisions set out. The schedules contain a number of core provisions. So we have the parties, the original obligors, that's the borrower and the borrower's group will be listed in Schedule 1. We have the original lenders, and we'll split this between UK non-bank and non-UK. And then we're going to have the conditions precedent. We list the conditions precedent in Schedule 2. The requests are the drawdown. Each loan we want to enter into has to be drawn down. So we have a standard drawdown request, which is provided for in Schedule 3. All the borrower or any of the borrower's company will do is execute the request, submit that to the agent bank, and then they will receive the funds as provided for under the documentation. We have a mandatory cost formula. The mandatory cost is an additional fee that the borrowers pay that covers the costs of the local, usually it's the central bank or the regulated authorities. Because these transactions are so large, the way that the local central bank, for example, the Bank of England in the City of London, or the regulatory authorities, the Financial Conduct Authority, FCA, and the Prudential Regulation Authority, PRA, operate, they fund their activities by making a very small charge against the largest banks with regards to their principal large outstanding commitments. So the mandatory cost formula is a very small fee, very small. It's a small part of a percentage which will be charged and paid over to the local central bank and regulated authorities to cover their ongoing administrative costs. Because these facilities are so large, even with a very small fee, with a large number of facilities, then this generates substantial running operational costs for the authorities. We have a transfer certificate in Schedule 5. Traditionally, this operates by way of novation. What's going to happen is, for example, one of the lenders wants to sell on, transfer on its commitment under the facility. It will then novate that. It's going to bring in another lender. Lender becomes a new party, the former lender becomes a non-party, it leaves the facility, and the new lender undertakes to assume all of the outstanding and continuing obligations as well as benefits from the rights available to the departing lender. We use novation when we're transferring rights and obligations. We can use assignment if we're only transferring the benefit under the facility. The LMA standard agreement has since been revised to include a new Schedule 6, which provides for an assignment. But as I've just mentioned, assignment only applies with regards to the benefits. In practice, we're usually going to want to transfer rights and obligations, and therefore we will use a novation in the form provided for under Schedule 5. This will then allow any of the lending banks to transfer on their commitment. If they only want to transfer benefits, we can do so with the Schedule 6 assignment. This will then benefit from the definition of legal assignment under Section 136 of the Law of Property Act 1925, which generally requires that the assignment is in writing It's for a fixed amount, an unconditional amount, and notice is given to the borrower. Very often in practice, the banks will not want to notify the other banks or the borrowers that they've transferred on their obligations, and therefore no notice is given. There is an issue with equitable assignment rather than legal assignment. If you don't give notice, it's then equitable. The problem is that you can lose priorities if another party who receives a subsequent assignment and gives notice first, but that generally tends not to be a problem in these large professional facilities because we're dealing with a specific number of counterparties in these professional markets. It's almost a closed system with all of the parties knowing each other and dealing with each other on a regular basis. We have forms of resignation, forms of compliance, a listing of existing security, which would then be excluded from the negative pledge clause, and confidentiality undertakings and a timetable. All of that is provided for in the basic schedule. So we can understand the document then in terms of these three core sets of provisions. We have the financials or the facilities, we have the obligations, and we have the default provisions. We can then see how the rest of the document is built up around this. With regards to drawdown, this operates by requiring the borrower or the borrower's group to submit a utilization request. The standard form for that is set out in the schedules, as we saw in Schedule 3. The borrower or any of the other borrowers as party to the borrower group will complete a utilization request. This will then specifically identify the facility. Is it the A or the B facility? The interest period and the currency. The borrower will then receive the funds, but only if the other conditions precedent that are set out in the document have been satisfied. So the way we incorporate the conditions precedent is that we make them, it becomes a condition that those have to have been satisfied before the drawdown is given effect to. This is almost a flawed asset clause, and we will come back and look at flawed asset provisions when we look at derivatives clauses and the standard documentation produced by the International Swaps and Derivatives Association. The core conditions precedent are then set out in Schedule 2. The standard clauses we would expect include constitutional documents, that's articles and memorandum of association for each of the borrower companies. All of the board resolutions, including specifically confirming that we can enter into this document and that each of the borrowers can guarantee each other's commitments, and usually a signature resolution as well, confirming that a particular board member can sign with a specimen signature. Specimen signatures are then specifically referred to in 3. We have guarantor resolutions in 4. No excess certificate. There's no breach of any separate provisions. Documentations are correct. All proper relevant legal opinions have been arranged. A separate opinion from the obligor has been obtained as necessary. The process agent for each jurisdiction in which we may have to enforce this, we have to have an agent on behalf of the borrower who's prepared to accept acceptance. So we have a process agent and then confirmation of that. Any other separate authorizations have to be referred to. The original financial statements must have been provided, and then any other relevant fees, costs and expenses have been paid. The borrower and the borrower's group can only draw down under the facility, either the A or the B, provided all of the constitutional documents have been complied with. Utilisation itself, this is then provided for under 5. This details the terms of the utilisation, so that's the delivery of the utilisation request, completion, currency and amount, lender's participation, and then cancellation. Original currencies. We will specify the currency under which the borrower wishes to draw in each utilization request. If the currency is unavailable, we will have an optional currency clause, and then we can also have a provision to change currency. The borrowers can draw down in different currencies under each relevant interest period. We will have provisions for repayment. If there's repayment of Facility A loans, because it's a term loan, that cannot be redrawn down again. If there's repayment of the B, because that's a revolver, the borrowers can then draw down again following that, depending upon any available period limits. The facility A will have set out in the definitions and interpretation, this is provided for top right, there will be an availability period and availability commitment. Each of the syndicate members commits to provide a portion and a percentage of the total amount available. In the example we provided, we had 10 banks lending to one company with 10 subsidiaries, that's 10 borrowers, 100 million. We can assume that each bank will make available 10 million each, although that does not have to be the case. It could be any proportion, which will be set out in the schedule listing the participating lending banks. Each bank then becomes liable to provide up to that amount as provided as the borrower's request under the utilization requests. There will then be an availability period. The borrower will be allowed to draw down under the facility A up to a certain time, for a certain period. If it's a 10-year facility, this might be for the first 2 years, it might be for the first three, it might be 4 or 5 years, it might be for the whole of the 10 years. That's not that common. There will very often be a limitation on the drawdown period. So it might be, for example, the first 2 years. The revolver facility may also have a limitation period. It might only be for 2 years or 5 years. Because it's a revolver, it might be for the whole of the period of the loan, depending upon the particular circumstances. The effect of this then is that what we have is we have one core paper that's governing all of these separate loans. All of the loans are independent and separate, and this is actually provided for, we will see specifically, in clause 2.2, A, B and C. Obligations are separate, rights are separate and independent, and we can have separate enforcement. What's happening is this. We are having, in this particular example, 10 banks, 10 borrowers. So there's at minimum 100 loans. But what will then happen is this. We can borrow for up to 100 million. The borrowers will very often and almost never borrow the full amount immediately in one go. They will borrow over a commitment period and they will borrow certain amounts. So for example, if the commitment period is 1 year, there are then 10 times 10, 100 times 12. $1,200 separate loans. If there's a 2 year commitment period, that would double to $2,400 separate loans. But then if we add in the revolving facility, if the revolving facility was 10 banks, 10 borrowers, and then we could draw down for up to 1 year, again, that's 10 times 10, that's 100. But if we then allowed that every month for 1 year, that would be 1,200. And if we allowed that for every year, for the full 10 years, that would be 12,200. If we then add back in the revolving A facility, we can have up to, for example, 13,200 separate loans under this single facility, under this one standard loan document. All of these loans are separate, they're independent, but they're all governed by a single standard set of terms and conditions. And this is one of the key benefits and value of this term loan arrangement, especially in the syndicated market. The obligations of each of the borrowers are then several, as specifically provided for under 2.2.2a, which means that if one of the other lenders decides not to or cannot lend, and we'll specifically see, for example, if there's an illegality, that's in section 8.1 further down. If one of the lenders cannot make available its full commitment, the others are not under any obligation to make that up. The liability is several and not joint and several. So none of the lenders have to cover any commitments of any of the other parties. In practice, what will happen is if one of the lenders cannot make available, in our example, 10 million, the agent bank will attempt to find a replacement party to to bring in. We'll then have the change of party, so we then look at the change of party provisions. We also specify that the rights are separate so that we can enforce against each one independently, and that we can enforce each one of these separately as well. That's all provided for under 2.2. This simply reflects underlying common law case law with regards to enforcing many of these actions. An interesting point is that many of the core clauses in this document are actually tied to specific cases. I haven't actually seen a book or any attempt to actually do that, to identify this, but a large number of these clauses will be tied to specific underlying legal decisions, which confirm that for the basis of the judgment, the ratio in that particular case, this is why we have to have that particular clause drafted in that particular manner. So we have the utilization, we have the currencies, and then we have the optional currencies. We have repayment. We've just mentioned if it's a facility A, you can, once it's repaid, you cannot draw down again. If it's a facility B, a revolver can be repaid, you can draw down again, depending upon whether there's any limit on the availability commitment period under the facility B. We then have prepayment and cancellation. We will allow the borrowers to prepay in certain circumstances. There may be an illegality, in which case it's compulsory that there's prepayment. The conditions for that are set out on the right. The lender will promptly notify the agent. Commitment is immediately cancelled. The borrower must repay that particular lender's participation. There are then other conditions that we can look at: change of control, voluntary cancellation, voluntary prepayment. The key point that arises is that the lending banks generally, for economic reasons, do not want prepayment. They want the term to be satisfied in full. They want to lend for 10 years because then they can generate interest payments for 10 years. If the borrowers prepay, that cuts down the length of the facility and therefore they lose money that they would otherwise have expected. We will, however, allow some prepayment, although there may be a requirement to pay what are called break costs. Break costs apply whereby the borrower has to compensate the banks for any loss in interest that would otherwise arise. We generally calculate the break costs for each interest period, and if, for example, there's a break costs provision applies, the borrower will then pay the amount of interest that was due for that interest period, for example 6 months, less what the bank can earn by placing the funds back into the interbank markets. So the break cost is the difference between the costs that the banks expect to receive against what they can receive by reapplying the money funds back into the interbank markets. This is important because this also explains how the funding actually operates. Each of the banks who are a member of this participant will not have $10 million available at the time they enter into the facility. Each of the banks is simply going to go into the interbank markets, supporting the Eurodollar market, and draw down the amount required and make that available to the agent bank, who then pools that with all the other payments from the other members to pay that over to the borrower. The banks who are making the funds available only draw down as they need, and they simply draw down by themselves going into the interbank markets in the Eurodollar scheme arrangement market as a whole and draw down at that time. For example, a utilization may be for 10 million. There's 10 banks, that's 1 million each. The utilization request will be delivered by the borrower to the agent. The agent bank notifies the syndicate members of the amount that they're required to pay. They will then each go into the market, draw down 1 million, pay the 1 million to the agent bank. Agent bank pools those funds into 10 million and then makes that available to the borrower. The interest payments are provided for in clause 9. The borrower principally pays the margin, the interbank rate, and the mandatory cost. We've already mentioned the mandatory cost formula, which is provided for in the schedule. The borrower is always going to pay two key things. It will pay the margin is the bank's profit, and this is usually expressed in terms of basis points, BPS. So for example, the facility may be 100 basis points, that's 1% interest. It might be 125 basis points, that's 1.25% interest. The margin is the profit. The bank's profit from that against their cost of funding, and their cost of funding are determined by the relevant interbank offered rate. And what happens is that the banks, for example in London, they will go into the interbank market. The normal standard reference rate for London was referred to as LIBOR, the London Interbank Offered Rate. Following the global financial crisis, LIBOR has been replaced by a number of other separate offered rates in each of the main financial centres. During the financial crisis, it was revealed that Barclays Bank specifically had slightly overestimated its LIBOR submission figures, and because of that, that undermined the validity of the system as a whole. The LIBOR operates by having a panel of banks. That's between 16 and 18 banks. Each day, they will quote a price as to what they expect that they can borrow interbank funds overnight, unsecured. They estimate the rate at which they can do that. This was managed formerly by the British Bankers Association, the BBA, and then the ICE, the Intercontinental Exchange. What would happen is a panel of between 16 and 18 banks report their estimated cost of borrowing. You deduct the two highest figures, the two lowest scores, and then you average all of the other figures together. That was how they calculated LIBOR on a daily basis. LIBOR was then calculated for, I think it was, five currencies with about nine separate bands. So there was a number of specific types of LIBOR that were available depending upon the nature of the specific facility. Because of the difficulties that had arisen during the global financial crisis, with Barclays slightly overstating its LIBOR figures, the decision was taken to abandon the old LIBOR model and then substitute that with a series of other interbank offered rates. What had happened was the Financial Conduct Authority had appointed a committee under its then chairman, Martin Wheatley. Wheatley reported in 2012. This was considered by the Bank of England and other authorities. This was included in, for example, a Fair and Efficient Markets Overview in 2015. The decision was then taken to abandon LIBOR with full effect from 1 January 2022. The principal new UK reference rate would be called SONIA, that's the sterling overnight interbank rate. Other financial centres adopted their own. So for example, in the United States, we now use SOFR, that's the secured overnight funding rate. In Tokyo, we had TIBOR. In Shanghai, we have SHIBOR. We have Hong Kong, HIBOR. The European Union had EURIBOR before, that was then replaced with IONA, E-O-N-I-A, and it's now ESTER, E-S-T-E-R, the Euro short-term rate. The objective is to establish within each of the main financial centres the average interbank offered rate, which is the rate at which the banks can borrow from each other. The borrower will then, under any standard documentation, if it's a floating rather than a fixed rate payment system, it will pay the interbank offered rate, the IBOR, I-B-O-R, interbank offered rate. So now it's SONIA in London, ESTER in Europe. And SOFR in the United States, plus the bank's profit and any additional mandatory cost. So the borrower at minimum is going to pay for each interest period, for each loan, for each currency drawdown, which was set out in the utilisation, it will pay margin plus IBOR plus the very small mandatory cost. If there's any changes, that will then be adjusted for each interest period. interest periods are provided for in 10. The borrower has to select the relevant interest period it wants to pay against. Most commonly, it will be 6 months, but there's also a default provision, which I think is 1 month. But you will then pay margin, the borrowing rate, IBOR, and the mandatory cost for each of those interest payments, each of those determined interest periods, which may vary depending upon the borrower's election. Now, what will also then happen in practice? The borrowers are also going to pay a number of other key provisions provided for under the documentation, and we will see how this works. So, for example, the borrower is also going to pay the fees. The commitment fee is a percentage of the facility paid to the lead bank or the arranging bank. The arranging fee, point 12.2, is the percentage amount paid to the lead bank or the arranging bank for putting the facility together. The commitment fee is a fee paid to each of the banks for making an undrawn amount available to begin with. In our example, it was 10 banks, 10 million each, so they will pay a commitment fee calculated against that for making that amount available. They will then, once the amount's drawn down, they will then receive the interest payment determined in accordance with clause 9. There's then a separate, very small agency fee that's paid to the agent bank to cover its administrative costs of dealing with all the payment administration under the facility once the facility's been set up. But what will also happen is this. We can consider and extend this 9.1, which refers to the margin, the LIBOR, and the mandatory cost. We can then extend that to include the fees in 12, any tax grossing up in 13 with other indemnities in 13, any other increased costs in 14, other indemnities in 15, and then any separate costs and expenses, that's transaction expenses, amendment and enforcement expenses in 17. So effectively, the borrower is paying all of these costs and will be responsible for all of that as part of its commitments under the documentation. The interest periods, as we've said, can vary. The borrower will select them for each period. We can have changes to the calculation of interest. Interest will generally be set by what's called the screen rate. That's the relevant IBOR rate published on the particular master screen, whichever was the relevant body providing this. It was the BBA, then it was the ICE, now it's the Bank of England. If there's any disruption, we will have an alternative screen rate, and then failing that, the parties will negotiate, and you'll see there they have to enter into negotiations. The break cost is then provided for in 14.4. That's if there's a prepayment within a particular period. The borrower has to compensate the banks for the difference between what the banks expected, that's the margin in 9.1a, and the IBOR in 9.1b. So the break cost is effectively the difference between 9.1a and b. The fees we have mentioned, the commitment fee is for the banks for making available their proportion under the facility, the arrangement fee goes to the lead bank for setting up the facility, agency fee to the agent bank for administering the payments following drawdown. Tax grossing up. All payments are expected to be made free of tax, which means that if withholding tax of any form is imposed on any of the borrowers in any of the jurisdictions, the tax payment has to be grossed up. That means that the total amount due is grossed up. If, for example, it's a $100 or $1,000, $10,000, and there's a 10% withholding tax, you don't add 10%, because if you add 10% to 100, that's 110. 10% from 110 is 11. So 110 take away 11 is 99. The banks would only receive 99. If you're grossing up because of the imposition of a withholding tax in any of the jurisdictions from 100 with a 10% withholding, you gross up to 111. You then take 10% of 111 is 11. 11 from 111 leaves 100. The banks expect to receive the amount that was set out in Article 9 free of any tax. So if there's any gross up, If there's any additional tax imposed, you have to gross up, which means that you deduct the total amount so that the banks receive the expected net payment. This also applies with the borrower having to pay any other separate tax amounts, such as stamp taxes, valuated or value-added tax. Any other increased cost in Clause 14 will be covered by the borrowers. There's also a separate currency indemnity, other indemnity, and indemnities to the agent that the borrowers have to pay. The lenders are subject to a general mitigation obligation in 16 to try and limit any costs so that the total charges to the borrower do not become excessive, although any separate transaction expenses, amendment costs and enforcement costs are also covered by the borrower in 17, so we can effectively add 17 again to 9 with 12, 13, 14 and 15. All of the borrowers are generally required to guarantee each other, so we have guarantee clauses in 18, guarantee and indemnity, continuing provision, reinstatement, no waiver, immediate recourse, all of the standard guarantee type clauses we would expect in a commercial undertaking are provided for here. We then set out the representations and warranties, so we have the legal and the corporate representations and warranties in 19.1. To a significant extent, these reflect the conditions precedent, although these will apply on a continuing basis. The core document has to be provided at the beginning in terms of the CPs, and then we also have representations, which are statements of fact, and then we also have the undertakings provided for in 19.1 to 14, and then the financial reps and W's in 20. We are then going to have the covenants. These are the continuing obligations which will apply after the facility has been drawn down. In practice, it appears that the CP is pre-loan agreement, the reps and W's are pre-drawdown, and the CAVs post-drawdown, but we will see from the reference to the utilisation request itself in 4 that effectively the CPs are pre-drawdown, the reps and W's are then pre-loan agreement being entered into, more generally, and then the covenants are post-drawdown. We also have what we call repeating clauses, repeaters, and we have evergreens, which means that they apply at all times. A number of the provisions, although they look like they should apply and have to be satisfied at a particular time, this may also be adjusted and vary in practice through the effects of these evergreen and repeating or re-repeated clauses. The continuing covenants are then set out with the financials in 21 and the general undertakings in 22. That's the corporate covs. In terms of the financial, these are usually expressed in terms of specific ratios. The ratios give the lending banks a substantial degree of control over the business activities of the borrowers. The banks do not want to become what we refer to as shadow directors. They do not want to direct the business of the company itself directly, because then they could become liable for any errors or mistakes or issues that may arise with regards to the conduct or misconduct of the borrowers. Short, less below becoming shadow directors, the banks are trying to obtain as much ability to not control directly, but influence and manage the activities of the borrower to protect their own lending interest. This is principally dealt with through the collection of information, but also the operation of the reps and W's as well as the continuing covs. A particularly useful way for the banks to manage the activities of the borrower indirectly and protect their own interest is through the use of these financial covenants. There's a number of specific financial covenants that are imposed. The borrowers have to stay within these on a daily basis, which means they have to comply with this at all times. The main ratios include, for example, minimum net worth, MNW, which is a solvency test, earnings before tax, depreciation and amortization is the EBITDA, consolidated net debt, dividend payment restrictions as a liquidity condition, cash retention as a liquidity condition again, and then there's also a leverage ratio, is total debt to tangible net worth. There's a large number of other more specific financial races which we can impose. We consider that further separately in relation to project finance transactions. The key point is that these are a very useful way of ensuring that the borrower and its activities stay within reasonable limits without actually having to manage its affairs on a day-to-day basis. The key corporate covenants, as we've mentioned, include the negative pledge and the disposals. We then tie breach of all of these into the events of default. The events of defaults we list in 23. So we have non-repayment, breach of the financial covenant, breach of other obligations, misrepresentation. We have cross-default, insolvency, other insolvency proceedings, other creditor process, ownership, change of ownership, unlawfulness, repudiation, and then the material adverse change clause. The two most sensitive provisions to always monitor are the cross-default in 23.5 and the material adverse change. This will be the cross-default specifically is tied to indebtedness, so we then need to go back and confirm the definition of indebtedness in the interpretation section, and I've provided listed that on the system there. We can then understand the operation of the system as a whole. We have the financials, we have the obligations, and then we tie these in with the defaults. In terms of additional more ancillary provisions, if we need to change the lenders, that's provided for in 24, and then using the transfer clauses in either Schedule 5 on an novation or an assignment basis. We have provisions for changes of obligors, the set procedure in each case. Clause 26 is an important provision as it establishes the relationship between the arranging bank, the agent bank, and the syndicates. The agent bank is appointed by all of the lenders independently. We specify the principal duties of the agent. The role of the arranger is specified to consist of no legal obligation of any form. The arranger will require that the documentation specifies that it has no legal responsibility to any of the parties of any form. This is so that if anything goes wrong and the borrower defaults, none of the banks can proceed against the arranging bank. We then also, we can limit liability through exclusion clauses, and we're going to have a core exclusion clause. We can also do this through what we call limited duty clauses or basis clauses. You cannot be held liable for breaching something if you were not responsible for carrying out the action in the first place. So, for example, we will see the role of the arranger in 26.3. That's a form of basis clause because what it's specifying is that the arranging bank and the agent bank, neither of them will owe any form of fiduciary duty to any of the other banks whatsoever. Therefore, there can be no breach of fiduciary obligation because there was no fiduciary duty in the first case. This is, I call them no duty clauses. It's also referred to as a basis clause because it determines the basis of the relationships between the parties. We've then got a standard exclusion clause in 26.9, which only allows liability in the event of gross negligence or willful default, which is a very high standard to determine. In all other cases, the arranging bank and the agent bank will exclude any form of liability against themselves. There's a number of other key standard clauses we would expect, including, for example, a confidentiality obligation in 26.12. We then have the sharing provisions in 27, allows the parties to engage in other business activity with the borrowers. So, for example, the agent bank can continue to provide other services outside this facility with the borrowers and the borrowers group. Sharing, this is pari passu distribution, is provided for in 28. Because all of the lenders are subject to an obligation of equality, they're meant to benefit equally under the provisions. If any of them receives a payment that's not made available to the other, lenders, they have to pay that to the agent bank. The agent bank will then divide it up and share it out with the other parties. This then acts as a form of disincentive for taking individual action and proceeding. In practice, any of the lenders can take separate independent action, because this is expressly provided for under the facilities clause in 2.2 above. However, if they do so, they're subject to the sharing provisions in 28. If any of the banks take action early, they receive any payments, they then have to share them, subject to certain exclusions, which is provided for in 28.5. We've then got the agent provisions. We have the payment mechanics in 29. We have set-off. We're going to have no set-off by the obligors against the lenders. That's provided for in 29.6. But then we protect the right of the lenders to set off against the obligors. That's the reverse in 30. Notice provisions are provided for in 31. Any other separate calculations or certificates, 32. There's no partial invalidity, no waiver and remedies, protection of remedies and no waiver, no loss of rights through waiver in 34. Separate provisions on amendments and waivers in 35, requiring consent. And then standard counterparty clause, and then we will have the basic governing law in 37 and 38. In all finance documentation, we will want to specify the law that's to govern the rights and duties of the parties. In practice, this is usually either English law or New York law. But what we will then also do is we need to select a jurisdiction. So we specify which courts should hear any disputes. So we have very important, very significant standard governing law and enforcement clauses in 37 and 38. The jurisdiction clause may or may not be different. It may be the courts in London, it may be English courts, or it may be New York. It could also be any other courts in the world, or it could be a reverse. So for example, we could have governing law but select New York courts, or we could have New York as the governing law and select the English courts. In that case, the English courts would apply New York law as a foreign law. This is very important. We need to specify how we can manage any disputes. The core objective in all of this, and this is the key purpose of drafting and careful, clever, informed drafting, is to anticipate all possible problems, which will obviously include disputes, and then to manage these in the documentation that we are entering into. So we will have governing law and we will have our jurisdiction. There's some other standard language in particular the jurisdiction and the service clause, which simply again reflects particular judicial decisions, so that if these have to be applied in practice, this would be fully upheld by the courts. The objective of all of this then is not to take this to court, but to avoid having to go to court. If there's any dispute, all of the rights, obligations of all of the parties should be clearly set out in the terms and conditions as specified. All possible eventualities are anticipated and provided for. And even in the event of a dispute, we have certain standard provisions to ensure that all of this is dealt with effectively, so that there can be no longer term loss of rights or interests, depending upon how all of the facts and circumstances come together in any particular case. The objective of core documentation drafting in the financial area and wider commercial area is to make sure that everything works effectively in practice and to protect the rights and parties of all of the parties to the extent proper and relevant.